Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests have taken a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this final episode of the series, it's a joy to welcome comedian and 37th Beatle, Mitch Benn. Hello.
Hello, Chris. Yes, thank you for inviting me to discuss the end credits.
You've either got the worst day or the best day.
Well, I mean, you know, how you look at it. I would imagine there would be there's a degree of summation coming up as well, as well as me discussing the interesting, you know, sans serif font that they were using. looked a bit like Gil Sans, but then people have finally twigged about him, so people are probably not going to use that anymore. Yeah.
So, yeah, yes. Before we start, overall, what did you think of Get Back?
Well, it's... You and I will never get to hang out with the Beatles for 3 weeks, but this is as close as we're ever going to get, isn't it? I mean, isn't it? It's an extraordinary piece of work. I mean, pinches of salt have to be taken. You know, you got to, as I've been saying, because I did my own little think piece on it on my YouTube channel, because every Beatles freak on the internet has now done a Get Back think piece, so, you know, why fight it? But it has to be borne in mind that, you know, I think Peter Jackson has a story that he's telling here. But what was so interesting is, and I know, I think you've had like 25 guests on, and I'll be the 25th person to make this point, is that what is so extraordinary is that this was a period of Beatle history that we thought was already fairly well documented. And turns out that we appear to have been wrong about it. For 50 years, we appear to have been wrong about a lot of things about this particular period in the Beatles. You know, my video was entitled Five Things I Didn't Know Till I Saw Get Back. You know, specifically that John was still perfectly content to be in the band. That there wasn't, you know, he was not yet in what you might call his po-faced messianic smackhead phase. You know, that was coming. Yeah, that was coming, but it wasn't there yet. You know, and in particular, what's particularly surprising is that he's stuck in fanny and about mode for the whole month. You know, the tension he creates, such tension as Lennon creates in this, is not for being a po-faced messianic smackhead. It's the fact that he can't take anything seriously. And I think that's what's winding George up in week one as much as anything else, is John just cannot stop farting about. The other thing is, you know, we all realise that even if we've been hailing him as a musical genius for 60 years, we've still underestimated Paul. I don't think it's only when you really see him and actually go, oh my God, this was actually a transcendent God-level musical genius. And also... breathtakingly hot. It's been quite amusing. You've had quite a few mentions of this, you know, watching all the ladies of Twitter and quite a few of the guys of Twitter just did absolute raptures about the mind-melting beauty of the 26-year-old Paul McCartney. And was he dyeing his hair, or was it actually Superman black in the 60s?
I think it was Superman.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And then the fact that George almost saves the Beatles by suggesting having a pre-arranged sabbatical to go and do solo albums each, on the understanding they're all going to get back together in 1972 or something. And it's been reported, because they have that conversation after they manage to persuade George back, and he explains that part of his problem is that he's got 10 years worth of Beatles tunes because he's only getting two on an album. And the thought of a girl off and make a solo album, you know, I could do some of those, and then I can come back and we can do more Beatles stuff. And John's like, oh, that'll be all right, that, you know. Because apparently Paul had no idea this conversation took place until literally about 6 weeks ago. And he's like, oh, if you said that in front of me, that would have worked. That'd have been good, though, you know. And it's like, oh my God, you couldn't have said that in front of each other, you know. And then the other thing is, it's just Ringo was always the Zen one. And I reckon, you know, history records that Ringo crapped out of Rishikesh because the food was given him the runs, and he couldn't get a decent cup of tea, and he'd smuggled a suitcase full of beans in with him, you know. And the joke about Ringo was that he was, because, you know, say, coming from Liverpool as I do, Ringo's the only working class one in the band. The rest of them are all from the, you know, the leafy suburbs like myself, and Ringo was from the Dingle, you know. And the joke about Ringo was always the one that he found all that kind of stuff going a bit over his head. I've actually now come to the opinion that the reason Ringo crapped out of Rishikesh early was because he was the one who didn't need it, because he's so zen. Ringo's just so zen. He's the only one in the band who is obviously entirely content with his lot, and he's incredibly sort of calm and attentive. The bit which, you know, the scene that everybody raves about in the whole thing, obviously we'll get to my bit in due course, you know, but the thing that everybody raves about is, of course, the scene where Paul's strumming the Hofner and summons Get Back out of the ether, you know, and it is an amazing thing to witness, although a couple of your guests, you know, like myself, musicians, have pointed out that it is weird because that's probably the first time people who've never written a song have actually seen that happen, whereas that is kind of what you do. You know, you noodle away on whatever instrument is to hand. You make weird sort of, you know, quasi-tonal vocalizations, and eventually something swims into focus. Now, of course, unless you're Paul McCartney, the thing that swims into focus is usually Get Back. But, you know, that is kind of how you construct songs. But what I love about that sequence is watching Ringo watching Paul. Because Ringo's just sort of staring intently at Paul. And one of his feet is dangled into... He's got his legs crossed. And one of his feet is sort of dangling into the edge of frame when it cuts back to Paul. And the moment that the weird noises coming out of Paul start to become Get Back, Ringo's foot starts tapping. And it's like almost he knows the moment that this is actually a song and not just Paul making noises, you know. And I found that really fascinating. So watching Ringo was fascinating. It really was. But no, the whole thing, let's face it, the whole thing is riveting. I mean, I think I saw Let It Be, as in the original Michael Lindsay Hogg cut. I think I saw that once, I think the last time it was on TV. Do your archives say when that was? Because I'm fairly sure it was about 76, 77, something like that. I would have been about 6 or 7 years old.
It was the Christmas of 79.
Right, okay, so later than that then. Right, okay. Well, I think I must have seen the Christmas 79 one because I remember being pretty young. And I don't really remember that much about it, except it had that kind of grainy, clunky, permanently slightly focus-shifting verite look of something like a World in Action report or something, you know, and it had that that kind of really sort of dour 16 mil kind of quality to it. And so, while there are moments in this that kind of have a slight Instagram filter look to them, the digital sharpening of the image is, it brings so much immediacy to what's going on, above and beyond taking a completely different approach, because as you said, it was bound to be a slightly sour affair when Michael Lindsay Hogg comes to do his first cut, because he's essentially been thwarted. You know, he had all these grand plans for something, and he ends up getting 3 weeks of studio arguments and then half an hour of, you know, freezing looking live performance on top of a roof. So it's not what he wanted to do, and that seems, again, this is pure surmise and possibly grossly unfair, that seems to have rather soured the initial presentation of what we got. Whereas, you know, Jackson's coming to it 50 years later with a completely different story to tell. If anything, he's trying to tell the story of how it went wrong and how it ultimately becomes something else. But the thing which Jackson has managed, for which he does deserve credit, and there's technical and artistic decisions gone into this, is making it feel like it's happening now. That's the most extraordinary thing about Get Back, is it kind of feels like it's happening now. We know it's not. Yeah, any glance at the technology or anything Glyn is wearing immediately makes it apparent that this is not happening now. But it kind of has that contemporary feel to it, and to the point where you're almost, you know, at the end of it, you're thinking, ooh, in season two, do we get to see them record Abbey Road?
You know? Yeah, that's a frustrating thing. I know.
Exactly. but no, because, you know, this is 50 years ago and half of them are dead. Oh, yeah, I remember now. You know, but one of the, I think that the cleverest artistic choice, a creative choice made by that, is to have no interjections whatsoever from the present day. The closest thing there is to a narrator voice in this are those occasional explanatory captions. And they don't contain any information that wouldn't have been available within about the next 12 months.
Yeah.
So the furthest into the future that those captions go is when, you know, as there's an example of it in the closing titles, when they finally nail Let It Be, a caption pops up and says, this is the take that's on the album. And that is as far into the future as the captions go. And I'm sure it would have been tempting to do, you know, like a 25 years later version of the anthology and get Paul and Ringo in to talk about it and everything. But by not doing that, it gives the feeling that we're watching something happening in real time, that we're watching something happening in Twickenham Studios right now, you know, or in Savile Row right now. And that makes that gives the whole thing an immediacy that you really wouldn't expect from something which is 50 years old. So it's extraordinary. That's the single smartest decision made in this was to keep the present day out of it. Is to keep, yes, you know, 2021 down to an absolute minimum, you know, and it really was very clever.
If anything, I think having Paul and Ringo on would have completely detracted from it.
No, it would have made it something else. It would have changed it. It would have turned into the anthology too, you know. And that in and of itself would have been a valid enterprise. But what they chose to do, I think, is much smarter and much more... And it's of a piece with Jackson's whole this is happening now attitude to... resurrecting archive documentary footage like he did with his World War One footage was to make it feel as much as possible like something you were watching happen in the present, you know, and employing some fairly heavy duty technology to do it, and you're watching actual images from the trenches in like 1917, but it was full color, pin sharp, correct motion, and with appropriate soundtracks added, and it was the closest thing you're ever going to get to HD video being shot in 1917. And it's the same with this. Yeah, that would have been one way of doing it, and you could have come up with something quite valid. I think this is way smarter. And I think this also now becomes in its own little way timeless. This is not going to be any more or less out of date in 20 years' time than it is today. There's nothing in this which is, because everything in this which is dated is already dated. Everything in this which you know, is in the past is already in the past. So you could happily watch this in, you know, they could watch this on the 100th anniversary in 2069. And it's not going to seem any more dated than it does right now, because there's nothing in it which is time sensitive that isn't already 50 years old. I think that's the point.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's an extraordinary achievement, and also I think you can kind of tell again things which will have been made, decisions which will have been made out of necessity, as opposed to, I think we ended up with the 3 2.5 hour chunks because that way George leaving becomes the cliffhanger ending of episode one.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think. One way or another, if they were going to do this in episodes, George leaving has to be a cliffhanger. Now, it's not like it's a cliffhanger that we don't all know the ending to, but it's still, when it happens, it looks pretty terminal. That's the thing. I think that's what comes as a shock, is that, no, George really has left.
Mm.
You know, he's not in a mood, and Paul says he's on strike, which I think is slightly belittling him, which is part of the whole problem, is that George and John do unconsciously belittle George. But when George leaves, he means it. And I don't think that really... I don't think we'd really appreciate that before that. Just how utterly through with this shit George was when he left, you know. And so that becomes a proper little cliffhanger ending at the end of episode one. How can we get George back? Even if, you know, it's like Apollo 13, you know. If you know your history, you know you don't die. You know they don't die. You know you get them back. But the tension comes from suddenly realising just how utterly doomed they were and how incredibly against the odds it was they were going to get them back. Similarly with this, it's not, will George come back? Of course he'll come back. But it's like, how are they going to get George back? Because he has totally had it with them at this point, you know. And that's... again, you know, who knew that this was actually going to have a dramatic arc?
Yes.
Never mind, you know, just lots of, you know, lots of wonderful warm footage that we've all waited our whole lives to see. Who knew that this would actually have a plot? So it's an extraordinary achievement. And the accolades that no doubt await it are all richly deserved.
Oh, definitely. As you say, Peter Jackson, he's had carte blanche, really. There was no approval process, really. But respect and adoration and absolute love of Michael Lindsay-Hogg, I just can't believe... Because bear in mind, when he made it, it was nixed by Klein and the Beatles to cut loads out.
Exactly.
He was also told
exactly
that, well, there's no point mentioning George because he was only gone a few days. So he had a tough remit to work with.
Exactly. What I end my video with a sort of a few words in defense of Michael Lindsay-Hogg, because I've thought, you know, Michael Lindsay-Hogg is still alive. Has he, since November, been in hiding for fear of people getting in his face and saying, will you shut the fuck up about Libyan amphitheatres? And it is slightly unfortunate that he comes across as a bit of a figure of fun in this, but I think the thing to remember is that what Peter Jackson has created is incredible, but the raw material he had to work from is only what Michael Lindsay-Hogg produced.
Yeah.
That none of this is happening were it not for Michael Lindsay-Hogg being essentially a pushy little bastard back in 1969. And also quite a cheeky bastard, because some of the techniques used to capture this are questionably ethical. The legendary flowerpot conversation where John and Paul are talking about how they're going to get George back, for which they had been bugged. And Michael Lindsay-Hogg bugged them. There's a hidden microphone in a flowerpot. I wonder how Paul feels knowing that he was being bugged and famously leaving the cameras rolling with bits of electrical tape stuck over the red lights. The Beatles don't know the cameras are rolling, so they just speak freely in front of the cameras, leaving tape decks running even when the cameras are off, so you get bits of dialogue. Knowing that you need 10 cameras to shoot the rooftop sequence and they're actually going to have to trespass on other people's rooftops in order to get some of the angles you want. So, yeah, there is a lot of respect due to Michael Lindsay-Hogg. I mean, the main problem is, I think, like a lot of people at the time, and I think that the other example of this is the argument over the name for Abbey Road, which is one thing the Beatles never were was grandiose.
Mm.
They were geniuses and they could occasionally be quite cinematic in what they were doing musically, but there was never any grandiosity to what they did. And what Michael Lindsay-Hogg is proposing is grandiose. It's not just that it's, you know, technically unfeasible, or it's not just that it's, you know, going to be a ridiculous idea trying to recruit 2,000 Beatle nerds and then drag them off around the world in a, you know, a rented cruise ship or whatever it is they're planning on doing.
I keep imagining that scenario. I keep imagining George on that ship. Just fuming.
Absolutely. How much longer is this going to be, Michael? You know. I keep throwing up. The main trouble with the Libya idea is that not just that it's hopelessly impractical, but that it's grandiose. The Beatles would have looked like twats playing an amphitheatre. They weren't that kind of band. That was coming. You know, in due course, the Pink Floyds of the world would tour ancient amphitheatres, and it looked great because it was Pink Floyd.
Mm.
Yeah, but the Beatles weren't grandiose. That was coming. That was the 70s, was the grandiosity. That was coming. The Beatles were not grandiose. I'm instantly reminded, I think somebody might have brought this up before, of the arguments over the name for Abbey Road, like 7 or 8 months later, when somebody has come up with the name Everest because it's meant to be their crowning achievement, despite the fact you've never heard an album that sounds less like a mountain than Abbey Road. You know, it sounds Abbey Road sounds like a, you know, it sounds like a sort of bohemian bookshop to me. You know, the story that they end up talking about, well, what's going to be on the cover? You know, well, are we going to have to go up a mountain? Is that what we're going to have to do? And I'm going to be standing on a bloody mountain somewhere. You know, I don't want to go all the way to the Himalayas. Well, we don't have to go to the Himalayas and just go back to the Alps. You know, where we did help, that'll look good. One snowy mountain looks the same as any other bloody snowy mountain, doesn't it? And I think eventually, I think it's Paul who says, look, this is all bloody daft. We're only talking about going up a mountain because of the name, and we don't even like the name. We could just go out there and stand in the streets and call it Abbey Road. Bing, light bulb, you know. And because this is it, grandiosity was not a Beatle thing. So that's the wrong tree that Michael Lindsay-Hogg is barking up for the whole thing, is it? He's trying to create something grandiose, and what he ends up with is something kind of ramshackle and improvisational. But that was often when the Beatles at the best. I mean, Paul says at one point, oh, is it our best when we're backs against the wall or something? And the Beatles were often at their best when they were just improvising like crazy. You know, make it sound like an orange, George. that was when the Beatles were at their most creative, you know.
Yeah, what you're saying about Abbey Road really reminds me of something George says in Get Back, where he's saying, well, usually if we plan stuff, it doesn't really work. Usually something happens. And it's exactly the same. You think, well, the decision to go on the rooftop was, oh, let's just go on the rooftop. decision to do the Abbey Road cover. Oh, let's just nip outside and do the Abbey Road cover.
Yes.
There is that all the way through the Beatles' career, that click, oh, we'll just do this. Yes. And that's what we now know.
Yeah, no, they were... And fortunately, they were surrounded by people who let them do that. I mean, that's... Yeah, I did a show about the Beatles years ago. I did a show, you alluded to it when you introduced me, and they go, Mitch Benn is the 37th Beatle. About sort of, you know, my own fascination with Beatle lore and my own sort of weird little connections to the Beatles, because I actually have a few sort of direct personal connections to the Beatles. And one of the things that... they were surrounded by people who actually let them get away with this kind of thing, because... The whole Beatles thing hangs together by this incredibly fragile web of coincidence, and you remove any one of the elements and it just wouldn't have come out the same. And one is the fact that they had management and production team who wanted them to be creative rather than just make money out of them. Mm. And that had never happened before in rock and roll, and it's not happened very often since. That with Epstein, you had somebody who was actually willing to indulge them in their creative whims. And in George Martin, you had somebody who facilitated their creative whims and seems to have loved every minute of doing it, rather than telling them to, you know, stand there, you know, smile for the camera and sing this, which very rarely happens in rock and roll, that you get that the backroom boys, that the management people, that the production people actually want the stars, the kids, the talent to flourish and experiment and grow and branch out, rather than just fleece them for as much money as possible for 5 years and then drop them and move on, which is what usually happens in the pop industry. You see that all the way from sort of the 50s onwards. Fleece until they turn 25 and then drop them and get a new bunch in, you know. Almost uniquely, that was not the case of the Beatles. Their managers and their producers and everything actually wanted to see what they could do, rather than tell them what to do. So you get these mad creative flourishes and mad technically creative flourishes as well. And as George and Paul both point out, they're always at their best when they're scrambling like crazy. I think it was John Morris pointed out, because I've heard a few of these, I think John Morris pointed out, one of the startling things is how rubbish all their gear is.
Well, yeah.
Everything looks all bit held together with gaffer tape. You know? Yeah. This is the Beatles. Why is Paul still playing his Hofner that he's had since, you know, Hamburg? You know, why are they all playing that Fender Bass 6? Has nobody got a right-handed bass? You know, we know, obviously Paul will only ever play left, but does nobody even own a right-handed bass anywhere in this building? You know, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. So we're on day 22, the last day.
Yes.
Friday, the 31st of January, 1969. Before we start, I mean, it's the last episode. Let's just, we've got to mention the previous day, the rooftop performance.
Yeah.
Where do we
go? It's just joyous, isn't it? it's just joyous, isn't it? And I love, you know, editing in the arguments with the bewildered coppers in the foyer. And then the bloke who realises that there's cameras on his roof comes wandering into the foyer and suddenly finds there's cameras in there as well. And it's just like, oh, hang on. You know, it's the whole of London under surveillance today. What's going on?
Well, just a couple of days ago, you can tell when we're recording this, 28th of January, we saw the official release, or streaming only, of Get Back, the rooftop performance with new mixes by Giles Martin and Sam O'Connell. Right. They sound amazing. Have a listen, they sound amazing.
Well, that's the thing, is, you know, the sound restoration, you know, a sound restoration along with the visual restoration is extraordinary. It's there's just something so joyous about the rooftop concert. And again, it's really great to see this back into some kind of context, because that has always, again, felt like an apology. You know, the way we've always talked about the rooftop concert, there's always been something slightly apologetic about it, that sort of, we've abandoned this album we were going to do, we've only got five songs ready, so here they all are twice, right, now we're off. Whereas, in actual fact, there is something kind of joyous about it. The one weird thing about the rooftop concert, which I still don't get, is why they don't play any oldies. I mean, you know, I know that the whole point is to record these new songs. But you would have thought, rather than open and close and get back, that, you know, they should have done Sora standing there. You know what I mean?
Well,
you guys, you backed out of a rock and roll four-piece and you've got Billy on the piano. You should have done Sora standing there.
Thankfully, you got that for the next 50 years at every Paul McCartney concert. So we were,
yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, why wouldn't you? I mean, this is it. People give Paul crap for playing the oldies. Yeah. If I'd written songs like that, I would be playing them on street corners. You know, never mind at my, you know, stadium gigs. Of course, he still does Sora standing there. Why wouldn't you? If you'd written it, you'd play it. You
absolutely.
Know, but you know, one of the good things about this as well is the sort of the slight rehabilitation of Paul, because he and Elton John have been sort of relegated to rock and roll's embarrassing old uncle. You know, they're sort of, you know, they're trotted out for special occasions, but are generally regarded as a bit cringe, you know. And it's like, no, it's Paul McCartney. Show some bloody respect, you know. Yeah. It really is, you know. It's Paul bloody McCartney. I'm sorry, you know. The man's earned his place in history and really should be granted that. Well, what can you say? It's the Let It Be rooftop concert. And again, it's another one of those things where you don't even realise... They don't even realise they're making history and setting precedent. But, you know, 20 years later, U2 do it in a video, you know. And then Paul did it on top of the, was it the Ed Sullivan Theatre when he was on Letterman about 10 years ago? And so, yeah, again, they don't even realise it. But U2 did it again on the roof of Broadcasting House, didn't they, in about 2008.
Yeah.
So it's like you don't even realise you're inventing a rock and roll tradition here. It was sort of the path of least resistance, you know. All right, we're not doing the bloody Libyan amphitheatre. We're not going to go down to Brighton Beach. We're not going to do it on Primrose Hill. It was sod it. We'll do it on top of a building that we own. That's something that we can do, you know. And so, again, the whole thing was meant to be a kind of a fallback position. It was meant to be sort of a bit of an afterthought. But even if it was, in doing, again, they're inventing a new rock and roll tradition. Even the stuff that they're just sort of throwing out at the last minute then somehow becomes tinged with greatness. You know, it's extraordinary.
Mm. Just so I've got it on record, so I want to read an email I received from
a
chap called Mike... Not one of those. From Brian Nicholson. And it just adds a little footnote.
Hello, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
Yes.
And he says, I don't know if you noticed a red and black square painting propped up near Ringo's drums. It caught my attention on first viewing. Why was it there? In early December, my colleague Joe, who has a double life as a sound engineer, told me that someone he vaguely knows had replied to a Facebook post of the gig saying, that's me on the roof. It's the guy in a purple jacket with black hair and a modish haircut. He's hidden at first behind the band near a chimney stack. And the guy is Tom Newman, who ended up a few years later producing Tubular Bells and releasing his own albums. And then he goes on, that's a good story in itself. However, a few days later, on a rewatch, I noticed that he himself picks up the painting. And Brian, basically, he pestered Joe to find out what Tom knows and how did he end up on the roof. And finally got an email. But what happened? Tom needed some money and took two of his paintings to London to try and sell them.
Okay.
And by chance, he bumped into a friend who was part of the film crew. And he told him, carry a bag of lenses, follow him, and they'll be able to get on the set to see the Beatles perform on the roof, which he did. He then says he sold one of the paintings to Neil Aspinall for £20. And the other painting is the one we see propped up by Ringo's drums. So next time you see it, you'll see a little painting. That's the story behind it.
And that's by Tom Newman. That's brilliant. I love the little serendipitous blips like that, you know. And, you know, we should talk, actually, about what we see over the end titles, because again, this is where, you know, Jackson's kind of, you know, invisible narrator hand comes in, because that's a serious afternoon's work that we see just kind of playing away as a sort of happy little montage under the end titles. That's the Beatles essentially recording half the Let It Be album in one day.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just kind of thrown away in the end titles, because I think Peter Jackson wanted to do the whole Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie thing of ending with the big gig, you know. So much as Bohemian Rhapsody gives Freddie age like 3 years early so that we could end it live.
Whoa.
this one kind of slightly glosses over the last day of the Let It Be session so we can end on the roof.
Yeah.
Because it's amazing just watching them doing what they're doing, and the fact that Lennon's sense of humour gets more and more sarcastic over the course of the day, to the point where the final words of the whole show are, they've got under to the bastards, you know, whatever he says.
Yeah.
You can tell that, but it is, if nothing else, it's like, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, there's a whole suddenly discovered I was halfway out of tune, but I continue playing because I ain't no good, you know, just the little improvised doodled song. I'm surprised there wasn't a caption for that, you know, oh, I suddenly discovered words Lennon and McCartney, you know, because everything else they sing, even four words of, gets a caption, but
You hear that on, they do a cover of Cole Porter's Friendship, which is a hit for Ethel Byrne. And the original lyrics are, if you're ever in a jam, here I am. If you're ever in a mess, SOS, which he changes to...
If you're ever in the shit, grab my tit.
Yeah. Which is, I don't know.
But that's what I mean about this thing that Lennon is in farting about mode for the whole month, you know, and by all accounts, you know, we'll get onto my own personal connection to the Beatles, but that is, you know, the way people who knew him describe him, just sort of always taking the piss, you know, at all times, out of himself, out of Paul, out of everybody, you know, just always. And but we even, you know, rather chillingly get a brief reprise of Run For Your Life, which is the second most reprehensible song the Beatles ever recorded.
What's the first?
Well, it's. I was thinking of them as Lennon's two great wife-beating anthems. It's that and You Can't Do That of Hard Day's Night. And You Can't Do That is musically the better of the two, but lyrically they're both, you know what I mean? Whether we're in character or not, John, these are not fun to listen to, you know. And then John finally behaving themselves as getting to the end of Two of Us, you know. Oh, that was the other thing I noticed, is that, again, talking about Ringo's ear for what makes a song work. You know, the one that I've seen, actually, there's a video on YouTube, I can't remember, some drum tutor pointing out that Ringo was, you know, a genius drummer rather than a technically brilliant drummer, because whatever Ringo does is what's right for the song. And the part he shows is the drum part for In My Life, which just basically goes bass, snare, bass, hat, snare, bass, snare, bass, hat, snare. And he said, somebody sitting behind a drum kit for the first time in their life could play the drum part for In My Life. But it holds that song together. It holds the song perfectly together. You can, you know, it's the simplest drum part. And what Ringo does, the things that Ringo come up with are not necessarily technically difficult to reproduce, but they are incredibly difficult to invent in the first place. So, you know, a decent drummer can do it, boom, boom, tick-a-ding, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But you try coming up with that, that's the point. You try coming up with that. But what I found really fascinating is, when they're trying to arrange Get Back, it's not quite coming together because he's got the wrong groove for it. He's got a kind of swinging groove. And then when they're trying to do Two of Us as like a full band piece, because in the end, Two of Us, he's just doing the kick drum, boom, da, boom, da, boom, da, boom, for most of the song. He does a little bit on the snare to get you into the middle eight. But most of that song is just literally, it's just I think, bass and hi-hat, and then boom, da, boom, da, boom, da, boom, da. But when they're first trying to do it, he's got a galloping groove on the snare, and I'm listening to this and going, that's the groove from Get Back, it's under the wrong song. Because Get Back doesn't swing, it gallops. That's the groove for Get Back, and there it is underneath Two of Us, and it's overpowering Two of Us, because Two of Us is a very gentle little sing-along, you know, it's I think, again, it was Bob Fisher said, it's, you know, John and Paul being, you know, Phil and Don again, you know, they being the Everly Brothers again.
Yeah.
It's a sort of very gentle little strum-along, and it doesn't need that kind of rhythmic input. And then suddenly, once they strip Two of Us down to the acoustic thing, it's almost, whether he deliberately does it or not, Ringo switches that galloping groove and puts it under Get Back, and suddenly there it is. That's the...
Always complimenting the song.
Always, always nailing the song together. You know, he was... Yeah, I'm part of my thing in the 37th Beatles is, you know, this... How off, and of course we all now know that, you know, that the whole quote about Ringo wasn't even the best drummer in the Beatles, which people have seen attributed variously to John and Paul. Neither of them said it. It's a Jasper Carrot joke from about 1977.
No, it's not.
Is it not? Is there an antecedent? Because
it's
that's
from,
what. I, go on.
Yeah, it was from Radioactive. Ah. It was said by Michael Fenton Stevens.
Did even? Right, written, okay.
And written by Jeff Perkins.
Yeah, Jeff. So, Jeff
so Jeffrey
Perkins
wrote that.
Right, yeah. Okay. Because I'd heard it attributed to Jasper Carrot. Well, that makes sense. But yeah, I do not believe that either John or Paul would ever have said that, even in jest, because. It was something I did on the 37th Beatles show is what in the mark of Ringo's genius is he's drumming along with songs that are being written by John Lennon, who literally didn't know what time signatures were.
Well, yeah.
He had no concept of time signatures. He wrote everything one beat at a time. And bars are entirely somebody else's problem. And the one I've always said is, you try counting along with Good Morning, Good Morning. It's one bar... Hang on, 1 bar 4/4, 2 bars 4/4, 1 bar 2/4. Then it's, I think it's 1 bar 4, but there's bars of 2, 3, and 4 all the way through it.
Yeah.
Or, what John Lennon was actually playing was 45 bars of 1/4,
Yeah. Then George Martin would have to score for the brass section.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So
blimey.
Yeah, exactly. So Lennon had no concept of time signatures. He just didn't give a shit. He wrote everything one beat at a time. Keep up, Nitch. That's a mark to the genius of Ringo, And then also, we've got it's interesting. I wonder if the George finally naffing off is what snapped John and Paul out of it and realised that they're still treating him like the little brother. Because Abbey Road is the album where you finally feel they respect George. Because it's not just that his songs are presented. It's particularly something. Listening to some, which of course you see the beginnings of in this, attracts me like a pomegranate or whatever it was going to be. When you get to the finished version of Something on Abbey Road, John and Paul's contributions to it are not just respectful, they're almost humble and reverent. It's almost like John and Paul are finally gone collectively, all right, we'll give you this one, George. This is a good one. This is probably, it's almost like John and Paul actually know that in terms of songwriting, that's the best track on the album, which it kind of is. Mm. And because Paul's bass line is a thing of beauty.
Have you heard the isolated vocal of that?
I've not, no. I mean, I've
have a listen.
Yeah.
Because it's on YouTube. And
fantastic.
What is the most beautiful thing about it is that you can hear Paul. It's basically Paul and George effectively doing a duet.
Yes.
You forget how much Paul is on that. But yeah. There's a beautiful bit where it goes into George's guitar solo and you hear Macca singing along to it. So he's really digging that guitar solo.
Yeah, I know. But it's one of George's best guitars.
Lovely.
That solo, it's beautiful. But I said John and Paul's contributions to that song, they feel almost deferential. It's like, you've written one that's at least as good as anything we can do, George. We finally acknowledge this, And I think that's. I wonder if George, leaving A makes them realise just how much they do actually need him around, and B, but also lovely little things like George being the one who encourages Ringo's songwriting, even if he has got that.
Yeah.
Even if he has got a lot of that. Oh, see, you've learned A minor. I love that line.
Yeah.
I love that. Oh, look at that. There's four chords in this one. That's brilliant, that. Yeah. Keep going, I see you. I watched that one also quite early on when they're jamming I've Got a Feeling. And it ends with just John and Paul trading. I got a feeling. For about a minute. And then there's a pause. Is this one called I've Got a Feeling? Brilliant.
We must mention this as well because we've met so many new people. I mean, this day starts with Paul Bond, who's the clapper and loader, who basically went on to do, he was a cinematographer and he went on to do things like Poirot, Lewis, Waking the Dead, Downton Abbey, Minder, London's Burning. But all these different people like Paul Bond, he's the little guy that was so enthusiastic when Paul was teaching him music theory.
Yes.
Kevin Harrington taking all the tea.
Ginger Kevin.
Debbie Wellham on reception. Yes. Keeping the police away. There's all these little characters. Glyn Johns.
Oh, Glyn is
amazing. We didn't really know before.
Well, apparently, this is one of the things, as I say, it's a long time since I've seen Let It Be. the original cut. But apparently one of the reasons it is A, a bit dour, and B, doesn't make an awful lot of sense, is apparently Alan Klein's insistence almost everybody but the Beatles was cut out of it. Mm-hmm. So there are no scenes with no Beatles in at all. So you wouldn't get any of the, you know, any of the sort of just the chats between George Martin and Glyn Johns, or Glyn Johns and Mal. Because, you know, this is a Beatles movie about the Beatles. So, you know, Mal is just this incredible genial person. You know, Mal, when he's getting to play the anvil, is just the happiest you've ever seen anybody, isn't he? How happy is Mal when he's playing his anvil?
The joy, you know, on
bing,
his face.
Bing. He's loving it. Absolutely loving it. But no, that's the thing, is apparently in the original cut, one of the ways they got it down to time was there's almost nobody in it, except you occasionally glimpse other people at the periphery, but it's the cameras are trained on the Beatles spinners the whole time. Whereas this gives you a much better idea of what's going on. And you know, that's the other thing which the other myth, which it not so much dispels, but certainly takes a chunk out of, is they were all sick to death of Yoko. It's like, maybe they would become sick to death of Yoko in due course, but they definitely weren't yet. And she's, you know, she's around a bit, but for example, when they're just kind of filling time waiting for George to come back, Paul is perfectly happy to jam along with Yoko making her weird wobbly noises. You know, it's not like he's, you know, I've had enough of this, it's just he's storming off, as you might expect. He's perfectly happy to jam along with that. And also, it's the fact that it's not just Yoko. Linda's there a lot. Linda rocks up with Baby Heather, and they waste a whole day playing with Baby Heather, as far as anyone can tell. There's that bit where Linda and Yoko are having an animated conversation about something, and nobody knows what, and I'd dearly love to know what they were talking about. Yeah, it's fascinating. So maybe there is that lovely line from the trailer, it'll be comical in 50 years' time. They say the ads are split off because Yoko sat on an amp, which is a lovely quote. But then again, that's also interesting because even then, Paul has got one eye on immortality, hasn't he? Even now, Paul is taking it for granted that this band will be being talked about in 50 years' time. And I think, he knows, because how could you not know by that stage? You know, you'd blown a hole in the world. So how could you not know that unless there is some kind of weird, you know, Cambodian year zero thing happens and all records are erased, then, you know, people will still be talking about this band in 50 years' time, you know, not least himself, you know.
I think the atmosphere, especially after yesterday, they're really, there's clearly on a buzz.
Well, I think they're relaxed now because they've done what they said they were going to do. You know, that was, you know, we've got to do a show at the end of this. And I think just the sheer bewilderment, as I pointed out, literally with about 48 hours left to go, they still don't even know where or what the show's going to be. And even then, when they decide on the roof, they're not 100% convinced that they're not just going to come through the roof once they get all the gear up there. You know, that was always a possibility, you know.
Those floorboards don't look secure to me.
Exactly, yeah. That was always a possibility, that they're just going to come straight through the roof, because, you know, obviously this roof is not designed to have a rock king on top of it. But it's, yeah, that done, you can see that so much of the tension is off. Now that's done. But then, of course, they're still producing these timeless works of art in this montage. This is when Let It Be gets recorded. Now, Let It Be is the most extraordinary song. Let It Be is one of those songs like Waterloo Sunset. It doesn't feel like it was written. It feels like it was discovered. It's almost impossible to imagine a time when Let It Be didn't exist. It feels absolutely, it's so elemental, that song. You know, it's not musically complicated. The only real sort of unexpected bit is the B flat in the little bridge. You know, that little bluesy B flat in the little bridge. Other than that, it's just, you know, the straightforward the four chords. You know, and it really, you know, starts off with, you know, in the classic four chord box. You know, the 1-5-6-4. You know, and other than the whole song is just over the four chords, and then the only real sort of tweak is that little bluesy that little bluesy flat seventh there is the only sort of musical surprise in the whole song. But it's just this work of pure perfection. Like I said, it's impossible to believe there was ever a time when that song didn't exist. And there's Paul, just, and out it comes, you know, and It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. It's like he's found something. And of course, you know, we may as well bring up that, you know, that's the song in which Paul is essentially communing with the memory of his dead mother. And, you know, I might as well say this. We weren't sure we were going to go this because my mum died a few days ago. And she was my direct link to the Beatles. Was my mum Jenny Benn or Jerry McLeod, as she was in them, because she grew up with them. She was at St. Silas Primary School with Ringo when they were 8. She's almost exactly the same age as Ringo, a little bit older than John. Almost exactly, when they were 8 years old, Ringo had a mad crush, or little Richie Starkey as he was, had a mad crush on my mum and used to follow around the playground. At one point he gave her a curtain ring and a box. I don't think she kept it. But this is actually documented in the Hunter Davis book. There's an interview with a woman called Mary Maguire, who was Ringo's childhood babysitter. And there's one paragraph ends with the words, at one point he brought his girlfriend to meet me and insisted her name was Gelatine. And that was my mum Geraldine when she was 8. Wow. And then when she was about 17, 18, she was briefly going out with Eric Griffiths during the Quarrymen days. And she only recently found this out, actually. She only told me a couple of years ago that after a Quarrymen gig, Lennon got a bit drunk and handsy with her, and she told it to naff off. So by the time my mum was 19, she turned down half the Beatles. So so that was, yes. So I've got all these funny... And then she went back to join... She took a few years off when I was born. She was working for the civil service in the employment exchange, as was in those days. And then she got her old job back in the 80s, by which time it'd been rebranded the Job Centre. And she's working in Garston Job Centre. And lo and behold, who's she working with but Pete Best? Because that's where he was in the 80s, is working in Garston Job Centre. So, but, you know, so I've got all these weird... And she was... It's weird. You think sometimes growing up with them, you might be a bit sort of, you know, oh, nothing bloody special, you know what I mean? But she was absolutely obsessed with them. She followed them avidly throughout the 60s. Never went to see them at the Cavern because she was the same age as them and they were a bit of a teen sensation in those days. And you know what it's like when you're 22, whatever the 16-year-olds are into is like horribly beneath you, you know? So she didn't, but she did go and see them the last time they played Liverpool, which is at the Empire, which I think was in late 63, just before they broke America. It might have been after, it might have been 64. Anyway, that was the last time they played Liverpool. They came back and played the Empire, so she went to see them then. But she followed their career absolutely avidly and was just agog with the rate of development. That's the other crazy thing. I mean, I'm not the only person to bring this up, is all of it happens in less than 7 years. What we're looking at now is less than 5 years after the Ed Sullivan Show.
Mm.
That's unfathomable, isn't it? Ed Sullivan was like February 64, and we're looking at January 69. It's less than, you know, not only is it only 6 and a bit years since their first ever release, which is October 62, it's only about 6 years after Please Please Me. It's less than 5 years since they broke America, what you're looking at here. It's crazy, isn't it?
It's 12 years since John and Paul met.
Yeah. John and Paul have only been part. But less than that, it was August 57, so it's like it's only 11 and a half years
well,
since
not
John
even
met
12.
Paul. Yeah, in August 57 they met at the Walton Church Fair. So John and Paul have only been mates for 11 and a half years at this point. And they say it's less than 5 years since they broke America. It's absolutely unfathomable. But say, you know, my parents, you know, my dad was a big fan too. And, you know, they followed their progress avidly throughout the whole of the 60s. And so I grew up absolutely immersed in Beatledom, you know, some of my earliest memories of my mum were sitting cross-legged on the floor in the living room in Hartell Avenue, where I grew up. Because that's the other thing, is I'm from the Beatley bit. You know, I went to Dovedale Primary School, same as John and George, and I'm from that part of town. You know, I'm from the Beatley part of town. And, you know, sitting cross-legged on the floor of the living room in Hartell Avenue with me mum and a little Dansette record player, and we would alternate pretty much two albums. So Freewheeling Bob Dylan, which is her favourite album ever, and the Hard Day's Night album. So I know I knew every word on the Hard Day's Night album by the time I was about 5. And I've kind of grown up absolutely immersed in Beatledom, you know, and with these curious little personal connections to it. And yeah, so whenever the Beatles come up, well, part of the reason that I emailed you when I found you were doing this is, A, I realised you were going to need about 25 people to do this, so it's all kind of answer to the pumps. But I'll be honest, there's a proprietorial twinge in me whenever the Beatles come up. It's just like, I'm not letting this happen without being a part of it, you know? if he's literally doing a podcast about the whole of Get Back, then I'm getting in there. I'm not having it happen without me, you know? So that was part of the reason I approached you there, to see if you needed anybody to do one of these. Because, yeah, I get a sort of a proprietorial twinge with regard to the Beatles, which is insane, I know, because if anybody belongs to the whole world, it's the Beatles. But, you know, I kind of feel I need to state my claim over them every now and again, which is just bizarre.
Well, no, I think it highlights for me, because doing this, it's taken like 2 months, really. Well, I mean, yeah. We're recording this, like, I think it's going up the day after tomorrow, I can't remember, it's literally last minute. Yeah. And you contacted me a few days ago and said the situation with your mum.
Yeah.
And like, I was like, well, don't worry, just don't worry about it. Somebody else will do it. And you were like, no, it's, I want to talk about the Beatles, I think it'll be therapeutic. And that shows what you were saying.
Very therapeutic. I mean, you know, when you're in a situation like this, when you've just had a, you know, and it was not a shock, but it came on in a bit of a rush. My dad died about 5 years ago, but he'd been ill for about 2 years. We had no notion there was anything wrong with my mum until Christmas, you know, so it's all kind of happened in the space of about 6 weeks. So, you know, it's good sometimes when you're in this kind of situation to have other things to do, because of course, as you will know if you've ever had a loved one die, suddenly you're buried in admin. You know, there's all kinds of people who have to be notified and stuff that has to be arranged. So that's taken up a lot of my time at the moment. So it was just quite nice to be able to talk about, you know, something else and something as completely joyous as this. And, you know, one of the last things she did was she watched Get Back. You know, when she was still at home at Christmas, so I checked into my Disney Plus account on her TV and said, now sit down and watch this, you'll love this, you know. And she did, she absolutely loved it, you know. And it's probably the closest she's getting to, you know, like I say, it's the closest you and I will ever get to hanging out with the Beatles. And this is the Beatles 10 years after they were her pals, you know. So it's, you know, kind of getting to hang out with her old mates again, you know. So that was, you know, I think she found it very much. It's just, you know, it's an extraordinary blend of emotions that it stirs up, you know. Because there is a bit of a come down when you get to the end of episode one and you remember that it's all 50 years ago and that, you know, that there will not be a season two. You know, because of course they immediately crack on with Abbey Road after this is done. You know, I think they get about a week off and then immediately crack on. Yeah, Abbey Road comes out months after this. And that's including the long medley and all the construction involved in that, which can't have been thrown together at the last minute, you know. They must have piled right into it and just cracked right on with Abbey Road the minute they were done with this. So
when they finished this, there were discussions about the album and they wanted to keep to the Get Back ethos by having seven songs per side. And John told the NME four more songs still needed to be recorded. So on the 22nd of February, Glyn Johns, he'd actually been in LA working with Steve Miller, he returned to Trident to do I Want You, She's So Heavy, which was intended for Get Back.
Right.
But then I think the whole ethos of, well, let's overdub this a bit, and then more overdubbing took, and I think that then
well, there's
pulled
something
that
like 12 guitars
back
on the go by the end of I Want You, She's So Heavy, isn't it? You know, they just layer up and layer up and layer up. Who was it the other day who said you could almost hear like Soundgarden coming in I Want You, She's So Heavy, you know? Yeah. You can almost, you know, it's well, that's the thing about the Beatles is, you know, their influence is ridiculous. You can take, they're really kind of creative period, sort of 65 to 69. You need to take any one song from that period and you can kind of instantly name the band that got its whole sound from that one song. I think that's literally true of Revolver. You know, I've done it with Revolver. You actually go through it one track at a time and go, this is the song that invents the jam. This is the song that invents Cooler Shaker. This is the song which defines the Kinks they were already going. This is the song that invents Tom Petty. This is the song, you know, it's like, you know, you can almost, you know, name every track on that album and here's the band which got their whole. She said, it's the Stone Roses. You know what I mean? You listen to she said, you go, that's the Stone Roses in 1966. There's, you know, and then it's Tomorrow Never Knows. That's the Chemical Brothers in 1966. Yeah. You know, and so you can name the band that got their whole sound from any one Beatles song from that era. It's nuts, the influence that they were wielding in those days, consciously or otherwise. But no, we genuinely will never see their like again. Apart from anything else, rock and roll in the 70s became so fragmented that while in the 60s, I think, certainly if you're talking about white music, it was absolutely undisputable who was the biggest band in the world. When you get to the 70s, who's the biggest band in the 70s? Depending on what you're talking about, it's kind of maybe it's Led Zeppelin, but maybe it's ABBA, you know, or maybe it's Bob Marley, or maybe it's the Bee Gees, you know what I mean? It kind of depends on, you know, what your frame of reference is. So I don't think there will ever be another undisputed biggest rock act in the world ever again. You know, there'll never be an undisputed heavyweight champion of pop ever again. You know, because in the 80s, maybe it was Michael Jackson, but by the same token, maybe it was U2. You know, it depends. You know, there's so many different metrics you can apply. So it's in the 60s, it was the Beatles, and their influence is extraordinary. You can take, you know, and again, you can see it from just everybody else is going on in the 60s. Everybody, you know, if you wanted to know what everybody else is going to be doing in 12 months' time, you looked at what the Beatles are doing now. and also, it's, you know, so many bands with their own distinctive sound acquired that sound by going for the Beatles sound and not quite getting it. You know, the Hollies invented the Hollies sound by kind of going for the Beatles sound and not quite nailing it. And now they've got their own sound. You know, the Hollies have got quite a distinctive sound. But it's an obvious attempt to sound like the Beatles, at least initially. You know, and it's kind of fascinating. Well, it's utterly fascinating. It's funny because, you know, I write this newspaper column and in the New European, and one of the things I was picking up on as we were sort of wading through all the Brexit detritus is suddenly realising, hang on, Brexit is to the boomers what the swing in 60s was to the Gen Xers. Because I kind of saw Britpop coming. Because I don't know what kind of age you are. I was born in 1970. So my entire generation spent the whole of the 70s and 80s essentially never being given a minute to forgive ourselves for missing the 60s. All we ever heard about is, oh, man, should have been here for the 60s, man. It's like, look, we didn't forget to set the alarm, okay? We didn't sleep in. We didn't show up late. That's not how it works. You know? But somehow we were just always blaming ourselves for missing the 60s. All we ever heard about was this incredible era that we just missed. Yeah. And so it was kind of inevitable that when the 90s come round and we're all in our 20s and we're supposed to be something new and fresh and exciting, half of us instead just do this half-assed 60s do-over. You know, and we're all playing Epiphones with Union Jacks on them and getting bow-led haircuts and then, you know, this desperate attempt in the popular press to try and resynthesize the Beatles v Stone thing as Blur versus Oasis, and as ever getting with the press, getting it the wrong bloody way around, because I'm sorry, but the Blur were the Beatles and Oasis were the Stones. They got it the wrong way around. Blur were the ones experimenting, and Oasis was just all about bottled attitude. There was no kind of real musical innovation going on there at all. Anyway, we were talking about Get Back, weren't we? We should get back to Get Back, is all we should do, you know. Yes.
So, I mean, the best thing about this, we get two of us, Long and Winding Road, Let It Be.
Yeah.
And so Let It Be, there's a lovely little moment where we get the version that we get on the album. And George Martin, a little conversation with, I think that's the best one. John, I think that was rather grand. I'd take one.
I think that was rather grand, yes. Are we supposed to giggle during the solo?
Yeah. And it's so lovely. But one thing I do find, you can tell me if I'm wrong or if I'm talking rubbish. I think the film, the way Peter Jackson's film ends, really reminds me of the end of The Graduate. Because basically, we've got spoilers if you haven't seen The Graduate, turn off.
Oh, it's perfect. But it's an amazing ending. And apparently it was serendipitous. Apparently that wasn't how it was meant to end. It was just, yes, but it missed the next 10 seconds. You know, Benjamin manages to steal Elaine, who he's decided is the love of his life, away from the altar, and they run away and they jump on the back of the bus and they drive off on the back of the bus. And apparently it was meant to cut with the two of them just sitting there looking all pleased with themselves as the bus drives again. But Mike Nichols leaves the camera running, and as the bus drives away, the smiles fade ever so slightly. They don't actually stop smiling, but the smiles become slightly troubled. And this vague look of, now what the fuck do we do? starts to pass across their faces as the end titles roll. And it's the most beautiful ambiguous ending because it totally undermines what's just happened. It's meant to be this great romantic ending. But of course, the thing about it is, when you ride off into the sunset, what's at the sunset?
Yeah.
you know, you don't cease to exist. And it's like, you know, no, these guys have just basically detonated their lives. And now what are they going to do? And it is the most beautiful ending a film's ever had. It's extraordinary. But you know, you're right.
This is a very similar feeling because so much of this, the arguments really and the tensions have been about doing take after take after take. Throughout this day, incidentally, they do dozens of takes of Let It Be.
Yes.
And Long and Winding Road. And you can hear them on the NAGRA tapes. They're clearly getting fatigued. But it ends with... Paul said, was that good enough? And Glenn's, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then Paul's little comment, we'll do one more just to cover ourselves. One more.
Fades out.
And that's what you said about John's. But that point in the fight, because there is no happily ever after.
No, because you know they're going to split up in a year's time, you know, and this is it. You know,
yeah. And I think Peter Jackson's done such a good job on that.
He has, because he can't not acknowledge that. He can't say, you know, Abba lived happily ever after and released another 12 albums before, you know, John Lennon died peacefully in his bed in, you know, 2009 or something, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, we know what comes next. We know that they completely fall out with each other over the course of the next 12 months and that, you know, they never get, you know, for all that John and Paul had a bit of a rapprochement back in the 70s, any hopes they'd ever get back together again get... cut short in the most hideous manner possible 11 years later, you know, 12 years, almost nearly 12 years later. And so we know what comes next. So Paul Jackson has to at least nod to that because he has slightly artificially engineered a happy ending for this movie. You know, it's kind of the Bohemian Rhapsody ending. You know, you tweak the timeline so that it ends with the triumphant performance, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Queen then released, you know, two fairly ropey albums, one good one, and then Freddie died, you know. Whereas, you know, it ends up, you know, and I don't really have a problem with that from a narrative point of view. I think Freddie would have probably quite liked, you know, being posthumously granted a sort of happy ending. I think that would have pleased him no end, to be honest. But I think with this, I don't know whether that was an inspiration for Jackson, that the way it end, you know, this is a coda, this is an epilogue, and the story ends with them, you know, wrapping up the rooftop gig. And so, it becomes... So what you end up with is the story, what we always thought was the story of the Beatles falling apart, becomes the story of pretty much the Beatles getting back together, you know?
Yes.
And that's what's so uplifting about it. It becomes the story of the Beatles starting off a bit aimless, still haven't really got any direction back since Brian died, coming back off the White Album. And so they're coming off the back of that. They're kind of devoid of any kind of new direction. They've got this bizarre idea. They instantly realise they've bitten off more than they can chew. They're winding each other up. One of them actually leaves and they have to plead with them to come back. And they're being pestered by, you know, this film director who's got this bizarre, grandiose plan that they don't really want to go along with, but they're kind of nominally going along with it to shut him up. And then eventually they've got to get out of the film studio. They're back in home territory. They realise that Magic Alex is full of shit and that none of his stuff worked. You know, and so the adversity is piling up and up in terms of the narrative. And then they finally, really, the turnaround is when Billy Preston turns up. And it's not even just that he ties the whole sound together. It's like they realize, oh shit, we've got it up our game here, you know, because I think the Beatles regard themselves in instrumental terms as gifted bluffers. Because you've even got that bit of George saying, you know, I'm not like Eric, I can't just start playing and see what happens. It doesn't work like that for me, you know. They're slightly in awe of virtuosos. You know, I think they regard themselves as gifted bluffers in terms of, and you know, that's how I regard myself. I am the archetypal gifted bluffer as an instrumentalist. You know, I can get away with it. You know, but I also know from, you know, working with my own keyboard player Kirsty, that when she comes in and puts a real piano track down rather than one that I faked you using MIDI, you know, when she comes out, suddenly it just lifts everything and ties it all together. And I think the real turning point in this movie, bizarrely, is the arrival of Billy Preston, because suddenly all these songs go from sounding half-assed to sounding like works of genius. And also it's like, well, we don't want to waste Billy's time. We can waste our own time. But, you know, we don't want to waste his time. So instantly they up their game. The minute Billy gets there, that's the turning point. They up their game, they start playing properly, they quit farting about or not as much. And suddenly then we're on the kind of redemption arc. And then it ends with them not just playing a gig, but actually being a bit rock and roll for the last time. Because not only are we playing stripped down rock and roll on the roof here, we're doing it literally with the coppers hammering on the door. You know, and that when you're a megastar in your late 20s, that's got to feel pretty good. You know, that's got to feel like, you know, I'm being a bit outlaw here. You know, it's back when we were bequiffed hooligans, because we're playing loud rock and roll while the coppers are literally trying to smash the door down. So that's good, you know. And so you have this redemption arc. So Jackson has created, and again, I'm sure there's a degree of artifice gone into this, but he's created this story. There is a story now, and it ultimately becomes a triumphant story. What we've always thought of as being, you know, the beginning of the end of the Beatles now becomes, you know, the Beatles getting it back together. And of course, you know, if you are watching this in ignorance of what happens next, then it ends optimistically, because George has already thrown out the idea that we could have a couple of years off and do the solo records and then come back. And that sounds like a plan, you know, and could possibly have been a plan, you know. I mean, ultimately, you know, I made this point in my video, ultimately it probably still wouldn't have happened, and that is definitely foreshadowed by John's enthusiasm for bringing Alan Klein in. You've got to say, John was not always a great judge of character, you know, because Magic Alex was John's idea, and so was Alan Klein.
Yeah.
So John was not always the best judge of character. And once Alan Klein's in, then, you know, it's doomed. Basically, one way or another, the wheels are going to come off this. And, you know, and they split up over what bands always split up about, which is money. That's what always does for bands, it's money. It's not crazy.
It's only three days after this that, against Paul's wishes, he's appointed the band's manager.
So exactly, yeah. Exactly. So this is it, you know. So that's kind of the first nail in the coffin, is bringing Klein in. Because if ever there was a guy who should never have been let anywhere near the Beatles, because he's the archetype of what I was talking about earlier on, which is, you know, get rich off him and dump him. You know, he's essentially an asset stripper, and the Beatles are an asset to be stripped, as far as he's concerned. You know, and so while the Beatles heretofore, and maybe they didn't realise quite how lucky they were in this regard, but while the Beatles heretofore have almost uniquely in the annals of rock and roll been surrounded by management and production team who want them to be as good as they can be rather than just as profitable as they can be. And perhaps actually have the vision to understand that those are one and the same consideration where the Beatles are concerned. You know, the more experimental they get, the more successful they become. He's the antithesis of that. He's get rich and get out. And somebody like that should never be let anywhere near the Beatles. And that, you know, so that's the one sort of ominous, well, you know, really ominous bit of foreshadowing, is that Klein is coming in, and that's when things are really going to start going wrong. But in this time period, this little capsule story that Jackson has created, you've got a proper peaks and troughs story arc, and it ends on a note of triumph. Even if you write that it's slightly mischievously undermined and subverted by the end montage. But it's still an amazing thing, and I'm so glad that they turned him loose in the archive, and you know, I'd just love to know what's on the other 43 hours.
Don't we all? So Mitch, Ben, thank you so much. Imagine for a moment, it's day 22, Friday the 31st of January 1969. Yes. You are Michael Lindsay Hogg. Finally, I haven't called him Martin Luther King. It's taken all these episodes.
Yes.
How would you be feeling about your little project?
Well, If I'm actually Michael Lindsay Hogg, I'm probably thinking to myself, what the hell can I put together out of this? Because that, I think, is what he was thinking. If I'm Michael Lindsay Hogg with the, suddenly the benefit of 50 years of vision, then you might be thinking, I've captured some incredible stuff here. I've captured a big slice of pop culture history, which will, you know, hopefully be cherished for decades to come. But that's certainly not where his head was at the time. I think his head was, finally, I've got something. What the hell can we do out of it? And, you know, and I think, you know, what the point that a lot of people have made, that the initial cut is slightly soured by Michael Lindsay Hogg's, probably, as far as he was concerned at that point, failure to achieve anything like what he'd wanted to achieve. And maybe not really being aware of what he actually had achieved. Which, because what he was going for, let's face it, what he wanted to create would have been a lot more artificial than what he ended up creating. The Twickenham Film Studios was a self-consciously artificial environment. It's not, that's not somewhere where you would write, rehearse and record an album. It's somewhere you shoot a movie. So there was already artifice at play, and trying to create this gaudy spectacle that he wants to end it with. Whereas what he's ended up with is something altogether more real and altogether more raw, and maybe he couldn't really get the distance. Because the other thing about MLH, you've got to remember, is he was incredibly young as well. For all that he's puffing on that ridiculous bloody cigar trying to look like a movie mogul, he was only... I mean, there's that line at one point where it says, you know, well, we're not kids anymore, we're 28 now.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, she says that, you know. So he was only the same age as John and Ringo, you know. So he was a kid himself. And so he probably didn't really have the kind of experience or perspective that you would need to be able to see what you actually had here. That by stumbling across, you know, because it was so far from what he wanted to do, he probably just thought, well, I'm going to have to cobble something together with, you know, all the just the odds and sods that I've ended up with, rather than, oh wow, I've actually captured something really unique, you know. But no, but I said I've got a degree of sympathy for him, and I hope that, you know, people are not giving him a hard time out of this, because ultimately he did make some very clever, if somewhat ethically questionable, decisions with regards to how he actually captured all this footage in the first place. And we wouldn't have any of this had he not been, frankly, a crafty little bugger back in January 69. We wouldn't have any of this.
And finally, Mitch, we've talked about this every time. What would Michael Lindsay Hogg think? What do you think? What does this mean to you, particularly in what's recently, you know, been through your life?
It's like getting them back for a few hours. That's the thing. That's the genius of it. Because, and for that, I think it's particularly... I'm sure it's quite a... Because that's the thing everybody's talking about, is it's a moving experience watching that. It's not just exciting, it's not just entertaining, although it's all these things as well, and occasionally it's very funny. But what it really is it's a moving experience. And I think, obviously, it will be very moving for people who do remember this time and were around, and there's going to be a lot of very, very happy and perhaps some bitter memories evoked by this. I think that it maybe is a particular significance to my generation, as in the generation that just missed it. Because it's like getting them back for a few hours, for a couple of days. You know, you can't really watch it in one go. Well, I'm sure some people have. But it's like getting them back for a few days. It's like the Beatles. That was the genius of not having the, you know, the 2020s narrator voice or having any interjections from old Ringo and old Paul. It makes it feel like it's happening now. And as such, it's a bit like getting the Beatles back just for a few hours. And that's something the world's really been waiting for 50 years now, was that feeling of having the Beatles back just for a little while. And we've had that, and that's an incredibly rare and precious thing. And for that, if nothing else, then all plaudits to Judah Peter Jackson for that.
Mitch Benn, thank you so much for doing this.
You're very welcome. Hope you pass the audition.
It's a wrap. Thank you so much for sticking with this for a whole month. First of all, thank you so much to the guests, John Bradley, Joel Morris, Felix White, Vicky Riley, Andy Miller, Nadia Shireen, Ellis James, Eleanor Gray, Dan Schreiber, Rob Manuel, RetroTube, Heather and Adam, John Rain, Claire Woodward, Nikki Campbell, Nelson Kumar, Julia Rayside, Bob Fisher, Margaret Caborn-Smith, Matt Everett. Thanks also to Arsalan Mohammed, who sadly couldn't make that one, Stuart McConey and Mitch Benn. But most of all, thank you to you for listening to this. I can't believe you've stuck with this for so long. It's been amazing, and it's been pure joy to do, real labour of love. Thanks to everybody. If you do want to contribute to the Patreon account, which I don't really push because, don't know, feel a bit funny, but if you do fancy popping a donation, maybe a present for Mrs. Eggpods, as we've barely seen each other for the last 2 months, pop over to patreon.com/eggpod. But for now, thank you so much, and hopefully there'll be some new episodes soon. Bye. Hey, 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 hey.